Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. The wrangling goes on, ladies and gentlemen, even as we speak. Up in Manchester, Andy Burnham is still holding firm on his position that he won't accept Tier 3 lockdown, despite the facts presented to him by the government that the critical care beds in Greater Manchester will be overwhelmed by this time next month. You just heard Vaughan Gethin there in Wales saying, if we don't do something now, we will be overwhelmed. Well, that may well be, or it may well not be, because could it be, for example, that Andy Burnham doesn't believe the government? Could it be that he knows something that they don't when they say they'll be overwhelmed by this time next month? Could it be that the projected figures are actually incorrect? We've got some very interesting information this morning to bring you. We've been talking to a statistician who will give us the real lowdown on the numbers game, and it's very different from the one that's being painted by the lockdown enthusiasts, including, of course, the government. Only yesterday, Labour MP Chris Bryant told a barefaced lie about the number of people in hospital beds on the Dan Wooden show after calling my drive time colleague a dangerous conspiracy theorist just because he questioned the figures. And he then called all the distinguished doctors who signed the Great Barrington Declaration crackpots. What would you expect from the new Labour Party? Pretty much like the old Labour Party, really. We'll ask Dr. Waqar Rashid what he makes of all that. And also, of the new figures out this morning, of all of the other deaths, which are up massively as a result of lockdown and as a result of COVID-19 being an obsessive disease that only can be fixed, apparently, by the government. 0344 499 1000. As ever, we need to hear from you, of course, especially if you are in lockdown or about to be. As far as I know, those who want to be are in a massive majority. So do call if you disagree with any of that. 0344 499 1000. Coming up later on, we're joined by commentator Esther Krakow with her take on the latest news from the USA on Trump and Biden, the reputation of TV's John Leslie, who was cleared yesterday of fondling a woman at a Christmas party 12 years ago. Will his reputation and his career ever recover? Seems unlikely, doesn't it? Plus, Dr. Rakeem Hassan will be here from the Henry Jackson Society on why the beheading of a teacher by an Islamic terrorist should be a wake-up call to the rest of Europe. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, right here on the fastest-growing radio station on the planet. It is, of course, Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, yesterday I told you there was a lot of nonsense being talked, a lot of mistruths being spoken, a lot of statistics, damned lies and other statistics were being used to try and make the point by the Welsh government, by the British government, by Andy Burnham up in Manchester. Nobody really believes, I don't think, that we are going to be overwhelmed. We weren't overwhelmed in the spring, and now there are fewer cases of COVID than there were back then. So surely the sensible thing to do is not to do what the Welsh have done, which is to lock down the entire country just because of a few deaths from COVID-19. We're going to talk to our first guest, Dr. Rashid, Waqar Rashid, right now, who's a consultant neurologist and an MS specialist, of course. Waqar, a very good morning to you. Welcome.
Morning, Mike. Pleasure to be with you.
Thanks very much indeed for coming back on to us. I mean, when I see these kinds of statistics, surgery postponed for 50,000 children in England between March and May, stroke treatments down 45%, 87,000 heart ultrasounds in England in April and May, down from 274,000, cancers detected each week down 58%, A&E visits down 52%. It goes on and on and on. You do wonder whether anyone in government is taking notes of what is actually happening around COVID-19 as a result of the obsession with COVID-19.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pleased that this has been given more publicity now, and I think there's been a couple of front pages and prominent newspaper articles in addition to the work that you've been doing on Talk Radio. So I'm pleased that this is starting to come to light, because I think genuinely a lot of people are not aware of this.
Yeah.
And I think when you hear even politicians, but also just people commenting in different forums, they seem to think lockdown is a risk-free panacea to rising infections. And people have got to understand that there is a really serious consequence to these actions, as you mentioned, with I think the figures put at about 26,000 excess home deaths for the period so far to date, over 100 per day, excess home deaths, not COVID, including in my specialty, people with dementia, Parkinson's disease, and so on. And so people have got to understand that when politicians and other people are saying, well, or scientists are advising lockdown, there is a cost to this. This is not simply a get out of jail card that we can do to take the pressure off the NHS.
Well, exactly right. And also, yesterday I began this campaign to try and get at the truth, Dr. Wakar, and it's very difficult because you keep seeing politicians claiming, as we've just heard Vaughan Gethin in Wales saying, you know, if we don't do something now, you know, we will be overwhelmed. Well, there's no guarantee of that whatsoever. Given the numbers of people who are dying in Wales and given the numbers of people in hospital and the capacity that they've got, they're misrepresenting it.
So this is the dreaded modelling again. So I heard a little bit of the interview yesterday with Chris Bryant and Dan Wootton.
Yes.
And I think
absolutely shocking from a person who's employed by the public purse to represent a constituency to call eminent doctors crackpots. I mean, what sort of madness is this?
I mean, you know, it's his opinion, but I think what he said in the interview, and I may be wrong on this, was he was claiming that there were 74% ICU beds occupied in his local hospital, which, you're going to have somebody on talking more about statistics. I'll take that at face value, but 74% is actually a pretty low figure.
Yes.
Routinely in the UK, we are always bordering on a knife edge, particularly as we get into this time of year and onwards, with critical care beds, figures of 85% above occupancy are normal. People may remember, if you think back several years or more, there were stories in the press of people having to travel hundreds of miles to get to ITU beds, and a national database was then set up. This goes back 10 years or more ago. So this is not a new problem. I'm sure you're going to talk about Manchester. I take my hat off to the local council leaders and the mayor there, who came out with this press statement yesterday, which really clarified the situation with their critical care beds at about 80-85% normal for this time of year. Despite all the things that were being put out about hospitals being overwhelmed, critical care beds being overwhelmed, the figure is as we would expect for this time of year.
Right, exactly right. And what I thought was appalling from Chris Bryant was not so much that he made out that was a dangerously high figure, but that when he was then asked what it was last year, he said, it was about half of that, which was actually a complete and utter falsehood, an absolute lie.
I heard that as well, and I thought, well, you know, what are they doing there then? They obviously don't need a hospital there.
Right.
I mean, 80, 85, getting up to 90 as we get to winter is normal. It shouldn't be. I think we should have more slack in the system in general.
Right.
But that's how it is in this country.
Well, I'm led to believe, Dr. Wakar, I was listening to somebody talking about the numbers of beds in the Greater Manchester area. Now, I'm told that of the critical care beds at the moment, 200 or so are occupied. There are apparently about 250 as a general rule in the whole area, which I'm sure you would say sounds about right. However, there is a capacity for 900 beds, if necessary, without even having to go for the Nightingale scenario, which is another 5,000. So all of this kind of we're all going to be overwhelmed nonsense is exactly that. It's nonsense, right?
Yeah, I mean, you've got to understand that the NHS has had to deal with, usually it's been flu or other viruses, have had to deal with outbreaks for years. And they come at pretty predictable time points. So it's not going to be a sort of a flat number throughout the year. They come in spikes at different time points, one of which it coincides with this time of year, but the bigger one is going to be around January time, which is actually, you know, I think a bigger issue. And so there is what's called surge capacity, and that includes working in networks with other hospitals and creating ITU level bays in normal or medium step down wards.
Yeah.
You just need the machinery and the staffing there, and you can make it, as has been shown with the creation of Nightingale Hospital. So, you know, it's not the case that we have this sort of set number and we're getting there and then, oh dear, we're overrunning, it's disaster. The setup is there to be flexible, work in networks, so this issue is avoided at all costs.
Exactly right. And also, we're also told, Dr. Wackar, that the treatment now is better because the cases which are being taken into hospital are being taken in sooner rather than later because the testing system is finding people quicker and therefore dealing with the problems faster, therefore more chance of them actually recovering. So we're not exactly in the same place as we were back in March and April anyway.
There's various theories about this. I mean, obviously there've been publicised use of dexamethasone. I think I think there was a rush. I hear anecdotally there was a bit of a rush to go too quickly to ventilators, which caused other respiratory complications early. So people have learned, and they've learned rapidly over a short period of time. And so certainly that looks to be the case, and the figures coming through that the outcomes are better. I think also people, the really very vulnerable and sick, unfortunately, if they got COVID in the first wave, sadly passed away. And so the underlying susceptibility of a person as well is relevant.
Yeah. What do you make of these people now, Doctor, who are saying, but it's all very well to just say the vulnerable, but actually the vulnerable covers about half the population. I've seen this argument now being made as the latest reason why we should lock down, that it's not just people maybe whose immune systems have been compromised, not just people suffering from cancer, not just people who are over the age of 80. You know, they've made this new kind of selection process, I suppose, if you like, putting more and more people into a vulnerable category because it makes it look worse.
Potentially there's, 15 to 20 million people out there who've got a chronic disease of some description. But if you look at the figures for mortality, so people dying, sadly dying with COVID, it's very clear where the risk lies. And that really is in the above 70, even above 80, but above 70, 75 population with at least one other health condition. But even in that group, most people do actually recover.
Yeah,
it's still a very significant majority who still recover. So, but it's very, very clear the data that's been collected now where the true vulnerability lies.
Yeah.
And I think we've got to remember that, it's fine to be saying we're protecting people's lives, but you're also then taking away their ability to interact with friends, family, enjoyment in life and so on. And I think that's a really serious, that's something that hasn't been really explored at all enough in people, is that do the vulnerable, truly vulnerable, actually want this type of protection and are actually happier for having this type of protection, particularly as, they still, even if they were to get a serious form of the condition, still more likely to survive.
Mm. Well, I ask every day now for people to call me if they really want to have these lockdown measures imposed. And so far, one of the only two people who have called me to say so, one wanted it because he ran a pub and he said my proper lockdown would actually get me compensation, whereas, the tier two lockdown doesn't. And the second one was an older gentleman who said that he wanted to be made safe and therefore he wanted everybody to be told to stay at home. But look at these excess deaths in homes that you mentioned earlier from March the 14th to September the 11th. Tens of thousands of more British people have died at home. Heart disease fatalities themselves rocketing by a quarter. Now, these are proper statistical rises rather than the ones we're talking about, which are projected. 26% up heart disease deaths on the five-year average. Lung cancer, 29% up. Prostate cancer, 53% up. 29% up for lung disease and bowel cancer, up 46%. I mean, these are incredible figures.
I mean, what do people, the scientists, advise in this and say, well, I think it's going to happen? If you take away primary care to a large degree, maybe 27 million appointments fewer this right. year, this period, than last year. And if you start to run a specialist health service, which is on the telephone at best or cancelled, I think we've kind of proven an experiment, if you like, that we do actually need doctors and health professionals, and our health is worse if we don't have them. Because, you know, what do people expect if you can't get medical attention? Your outcomes and deaths and so on rise. So we've kind of proven we need to provide a health service, and we ought to be providing it.
No, exactly right. I've got a question here from a listener called Vic who says, can you please ask Dr. Wakar about forthcoming vaccines and therapeutics? I'm not sure what that is. Trump likes Regeneron and Valence has high hopes for new RNA vaccines, he says.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a bit of a sort of a moving sort of calendar sort of thing, hasn't it? I've written a couple of pieces online for the Spectator on viruses, and initially there was talk of September, October. That's clearly not going to happen. I think, you know, there was a bit of murmurings about one or two people or some groups having end of this year. I don't think that's going to be the case. I think spring at the earliest. But I think what's increasingly coming out as well, when you hear some of the scientific advisors, is that it's not going to be a simple jab for, you know, measles or whatever it may be that means you don't get the infection. This is going to be much more a case of something that's trying to build up immunity and may not give complete immunity. And the problem is as well with vaccines, and I'm very pro-vaccine, don't get me wrong, but the problem is with vaccines is that in the most vulnerable people, so the very old and the immunosuppressed, they don't work as well because they're reliant on having a competent immune system to make an ideal response. And unfortunately, this is precisely the age group that are most at risk of COVID. So, and I think that's why I saw Patrick Vallance say in a press release that even with a vaccine, this is not going to, and ultimately we need to live with this virus. Mm. And the way you live with this virus is actually trying to develop strategies where you actually live rather than hide from it indefinitely.
Yeah, but unfortunately, nobody in the government seems to be taking that particular advice, Dr. Wakar. And as long as you've got people like Chris Bryant calling people like you crackpots, it's never going to happen, is it?
Well, I think, I don't know, I may be in a minority here, but I actually think, although I'm not in favour and of the tier system, and I think what's being seen is it's unnecessary in large part, but I actually think by the government not going for this so-called circuit break lockdown actually was quite a significant thing, because they were very strongly advised to do this by Sage, and they said no to Sage. And it would have been very easy for them to have done a circuit break, because they could have said, you know, to the people saying, why are you doing this? Well, we're following the science. That's what has been, you know, the case for months and months. We're going with the science. And they didn't do it. And so I think they're starting to cotton on that perhaps all the advice they're getting from Sage isn't the most balanced advice. It's fantastic advice if your interest is in viral suppression and not worrying about the consequences. But they have to now govern and think of the consequences for everyone. I think possibly I saw signs that maybe they're starting to do that. I hope they are.
Well, I hope so too, because for me it's a bit like cancelling all buses on the grounds that you don't want one of them to be full up with people, and therefore let's just stop running buses so nobody gets to go anywhere. You know, the damage that's being done to the economy is palpable. It's very easy to see. The damage that's being done to people, I mean, that's the other thing that we keep being warned about, that, you know, oh, if we don't do something now, you know, other health services will be affected. Well, guess what? They're already affected.
Yeah, exactly. It's when you just see one side of the equation completely. And I think, you know, even when you talk to or you hear people being questioned on Sage or Independent Sage or whatever they are about, you know, the damaging effects of this, the standard response back is, well, if COVID gets out of control, everything falls apart. So right. You can see where the motivation is. It's COVID. That's the thing. And if we let COVID get out of control, forget about the economy and other people's health. But I think they are really not balanced in this. And I've said in various things in print and on Twitter that they need better, more broader representation on these panels.
Well, they really do. And also, when you look at Liverpool and Wales soon to go into lockdown on Friday, if we get to the end of that period of 2 weeks or, you know, 14 days or 17 days, whatever it is, and the COVID rates have not gone down, what happens then?
Yeah, I heard the Welsh Health Minister Vaughan Gethin say he isn't actually expecting at the end of his so we call it firebreak lockdown rates to actually come down. And well, you know, you then start to wonder, well, what is the point? Apart from particularly as there is damage to what is being advised. So I guess the immediate comeback you get is, oh, it would have been worse had we not done it. So, but you can't prove that. And, you know, it's a great way to have an argument to say, well, had we not done it, this and this would have happened without any evidence of proof. And it just seems we have to take it at face value, really.
I mean, I did say back in the beginning that, yeah, when we were told we needed to save the NHS and therefore stop the cases from overwhelming the NHS, that did appear to work. But Peter Hitchens always said to me, yeah, but how do you know that it wouldn't have been like that anyway? And the answer is you don't know.
You don't know. That's very true. But there were some very, very frightening and worrying stories out there at the time. And so I personally wasn't particularly. I just don't see the scientific merit of lockdown as a theory anyway. But you know, 2-3 week period, if we were really concerned, and it, you know, it was bad. Then you know, you kind of get where they're coming from with that. But then it, you know, it's just spiraled out of control, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, don't say that anywhere near Chris Bryant, because he may have something rather nasty to say to you as a result. Dr. Waqar Rashid, thank you very much indeed. Consultant neurologist, MS specialist, not in favour of lockdowns, still very sensible. He would be called a crackpot by Chris Bryant, disgracefully.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Let's talk to Jamie Jenkins, who's an award-winning analytical leader, according to his Twitter account. He is, in fact, former head of health analysis at the Office of National Statistics. Jamie, welcome. Very good morning to you.
Morning, Mike.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Now, you've got a fascinating background in statistics, and I think you are sorely needed at this particular juncture, because I'm getting very frustrated being shown a load of numbers and figures that I frankly don't think are backed up by facts.
So what we can see, if you look at Wales, for example, I mean, you can look at England as well, but what we can see is that through September, we did see a slight uptick in the number of patients on ventilators in Wales. And right. Currently stands around 30 patients. Now, the First Minister of Wales yesterday was saying that critical care in Wales is at capacity. But if you actually look at the numbers and the 30 patients, we've actually got 100 beds vacant at the moment in Wales. Right. And the 30 people who are on ventilated beds at the moment, now that hasn't increased for the last 2 weeks. Now, for each and every one of them that's on a ventilator at the moment, that's worrying for the families and fingers crossed for their recovery. But we're not seeing an acceleration in the number of people on intensive care beds at the moment. And that's got to be a positive, I think.
Well, I think so. And also looking at the numbers of deaths, I think I'm right in saying that certainly for the past week, possibly 2 weeks, the numbers have been in single figures, haven't they?
Yeah, so deaths are running relatively low at the moment. They've increased slightly, but we know that some of the deaths in Wales over the past few weeks have been linked to an outbreak in the hospital that's actually local to where I live, the Royal Glamorgan Hospital, which is the local hospital as well of Chris Bryant, the MP, that's been talking about the figures of hospitalisation.
Our favourite Labour MP here at Talk Radio, he's the guy that thinks anyone who doesn't want a lockdown, even if they're medically qualified, is a crackpot.
Well, that's obviously Chris's opinion on regards to all of that. But if we focus on the deaths, then they are relatively low, and some of the outbreaks in the Royal Glamorgan Hospital affected that. There's a number of facts and figures that really I think the public need to understand here. So if you go back a month ago, about 2.2% of people being tested for COVID in Wales were coming back positive. And that has increased quite a lot over the last month or so. So the Welsh government, you could argue, using that evidence would warrant to doing some more measures because the restrictions that are in place aren't working. However, just looking at the cases themselves, that only tells you part of the story. So we know that 70% of the cases in the latest week for Wales were for people under 50.
Yeah.
We know that there were double the number of cases among 10 to 19-year-olds than there were among 60 to 69-year-olds. And then if you put that in relation to the deaths that you've talked about, we also know that only 1% of deaths have actually occurred in people aged under 45. So the relative risk of death for the cases that have been kind of the most prominent in Wales at the moment is relatively low.
Mm. And that's an important distinction, I think, that you make. And if it has gone up, say, from 2.5% to, say, 5%, and they can then say, well, look, you know, we've got double the number of cases. Well, first of all, you've only got double the number of infections, and you don't know if any of those people are ill. And that's the bit that they also don't tell us. You've also then got 95% of people who don't have any problem at all. So you're kind of going, all right, well, now let's look at this graph, because I noticed that on your Twitter, you've got an interesting graph in which the projection says that the worst case scenario is going to happen sometime between sort of December, Christmas, December the 25th and 25th of January. But the flat line is going from July to August to September, rising slightly through the 25th of October, but not really doing anything interesting until way ahead into the future, which is obviously a projection and a model.
So Swansea University have come up with that model, and I've tried looking into kind of the more detail on that, but I've been struggling to find out the full detail of it. And what is projecting actually is the number of hospital admissions in Wales will be about three times what it was back at the height of the pandemic in April. Now, what we do know now is there's a virus out there. So you'd expect that the measures that are in place in terms of social distancing and with regards to there's better treatments, etc. You'd expect things with local lockdowns, where there are restrictions, for the numbers to potentially be lower. We do know, though, that there is always increased hospital admissions during the winter months. But it does seem kind of, it's a worst case scenario. It does seem quite an extreme worst case scenario for it just to kind of suddenly accelerate when you go back into the end of November. And I've also been looking at the Office for National Statistics figures for Wales on employment. So I think at the moment in the pandemic, we are at that kind of part where we know the furlough payments are coming to an end at the end of October. Mm. And if you look at the actual data with regards to Wales, that since after the first lockdown, 30,000 people kind of lost their jobs in Wales. And that doesn't even include the impact of the self-employed. So there's evidence that you need some further restrictions if you want to curb the kind of the virus in terms of its spread. We know that it's spreading more kind of at the moment in Wales. However, there's the wider economic impacts. There's the number of jobs that are being lost. Obviously, that's going to probably go up in the winter months as well as the furlough comes to an end. There's all these other factors that need to be thought about when you're deciding, you know, whether you're going to have a lockdown or whether you have restrictions or not.
But that's interesting as well, because as a statistician, I mean, you know, I could draw one of those graphs. So Patrick Vallance did one similar in which he said there would be 50,000 infections a day by November unless we did something, right? And he then later admitted that they just kind of drew that because they thought that might scare people. Now, this one looks as if it's been drawn by the same hand, you know, because it goes blah, 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 and it suddenly goes like that. I mean, I could do that. What I don't see, and what I've never seen, Jamie, is a projection of what's going to happen to the infection rate if we do have a lockdown, because I don't know why they don't want to show us that.
Well, that's one of the challenges I think we're going to have now, is that they've used this chart and the projection to kind of justify why we need a lockdown and an urgent circuit break or fire break in Wales.
Right.
But actually implementing that policy itself then means that you can never work out if that projection will happen, because you can obviously say that, well, we were never going to achieve that now because we implemented the fire break. So it's one of those situations where you use some data to justify a policy and then use the policy to say why the data would never happen in the first place.
Because most people,
difficult.
Yeah, I mean, most people who are sceptical of lockdowns would say, well, you know, what's the likelihood that as soon as the lockdown is over, the infection rate will go up again as soon as people start going out of their houses, which is pretty much a given, isn't it?
Well, the virus isn't going to go away, and we know that. And until we're getting a vaccine, we know also that you're kind of right there, that it's kind of like playing a pause button on the actual video that you're watching, and then you come back and then it starts again.
Right.
I suppose people who would argue for a lockdown would say that we're better off pausing the button so we can get over that massive peak in the winter.
Right.
That would be the arguments, I suppose, for the lockdown. But then you've also got, say, the economic arguments, that pressing the pause and all of the kind of the economic fallout of all of that. And that's going to hit people at the exact same time that the furlough scheme's coming to an end.
Yeah.
So until we have a vaccine, locking down kind of inevitably just pauses things, and they'll continue to go on and on and on as we go forward.
But why do you think, Jamie, and I know this is maybe a health question that you may not feel qualified to answer, but why do you think that suddenly there's this obsession with trying to control this particular virus? Because I accept that it's not like flu. I accept that it does really, really damage some people quite badly, although albeit a smallish number. But there's an awful lot of people die from flu every year, and we don't get told, don't go outside, you know, don't go to work, work from home. Nobody says any of that about flu, and yet it does kill a lot of people.
Well, if you go back to March, it is quite clear from the kind of the official data that there was a mass number of excess deaths. But in part, that was assisted in a kind of a tragic way by care homes. And we didn't know about the virus. And then a lot of people who were elderly were dying because of the virus there. And I think kind of the politicians, the ministers, and many members of the public can still remember the kind of the pandemic back in April, which is why there's these measures that they're always thinking in terms of curbing the virus. But you're right, you've only got to go back a few years ago. The flu vaccine in the UK wasn't as effective as one would like. And we saw quite a large number of excess deaths in the winter months just a few years ago. And you're kind of right with regards to that, that we do have an impact. Again, the other argument would be that we do have a flu vaccine, so it does protect the vulnerable more, and we don't have a vaccine for COVID. So there is obviously more of an obsession with COVID to kind of curb it, because we're not entirely sure where we're heading with the virus. Mm. But I think the current data wouldn't lend itself. Like, if you take hospital admissions and the hospitalizations in Wales, apart from one health board, which is the Cwm Taf Health Board, which is in the area I live, where we've seen some of the outbreaks, many hospital areas across Wales haven't seen much of a change in hospital admissions over the past kind of month. So when you're using that data to putting a national lockdown, you can kind of see why there's quite a lot of anger among some people, yeah, rightly or wrongly, whether or not we should lock down West Wales when we know, for example, it's much, much lower there than it is in the Welsh valleys, for example.
Yeah, right. Well, that was what I was going to ask you, my last question, Jamie. As a resident of Wales, what are people saying about this, and what are they prepared to do? Because obviously, you know, in parts of Britain, parts of England, certainly, people haven't exactly adhered to what they've been told to do.
Well, you can see on social media and from friends I talk to, there's obviously a lot of anger for it, but there's also a lot of positivity. So it kind of reminds me a bit like Brexit all over again with Remain and Leave. You've got two different opposing opinions, and there's valid arguments for both. I think for me, I look at it more from an evidence-based perspective, and I wouldn't say the evidence would lend itself that you should have the exact same restrictions across the whole of Wales. However, one who's supportive of a lockdown probably would say that if everybody's in it together and they're the same restrictions are in place, you're more likely to get that. And if you actually focus just briefly before I finish on England, you can see that hospital and admissions in the northwest of England are 8 times faster, or higher, sorry, and going up faster than they are in the south of England, in the southeast. So again, there's talk, I think, from Keir Starmer to have a national lockdown for the whole of the UK, including England there. But the data would suggest there's definitely an acute problem in the northwest of England, not so much in the southeast, but a lockdown would impact economically on all areas.
No, exactly right. Jamie, listen, great to talk to you. Thanks very much indeed. I'm sure we'll do it again. Jamie Jenkins, their former head of health analysis at the Office for National Statistics, with some statistics which would suggest that this graph, for example, I'm going to retweet it in a moment. This graph that has been produced about COVID hospital admissions, it's basically just, you know, stick a number in the air, double it, triple it, and then draw a graph and take the final part of the graph up to the top. I mean, you know, where have we seen that before? Tell me. This is Talk Radio.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, there's always an awful lot to talk about on this show, and I'm very pleased to say that we're now going to talk about an awful lot of things with Esther Cracker. Esther, welcome back. Nice
Thank
to see you.
Thank you for having me.
Not at all. Welcome back to your regular slot now. I'm looking at an email that I've just received from one of my retail people that send me emails from time to time saying, Halloween at home this year? Well, where else are you going to be doing it? I mean, there's not going to be much trick-or-treating going on. Prepare to scare yourself silly, they say. Make your own haunted house.
Oh, gosh. I mean, no, I'm sorry. I'm not that invested in Halloween.
I'm really not that invested in Halloween either. But it is going to be a pretty scary time, apparently, according to the government.
It's more American than anything. I hardly see trick-or-treaters in this country.
You really don't. I mean, they've tried to make it into a massive thing, but I'm not really buying it. But the bonfire nights have all been cancelled. You know, fireworks have all been cancelled. Poor old Sadiq Khan has now said that he can't organise a firework display because it might be dangerous for people to catch.
Because we're outdoors.
And it's really cold,
yeah,
and therefore, you know, somehow it might be the wrong thing. But let's start off, let's kick off with Trump versus Biden, because it's been an interesting week. There's been a lot of rallies. It's been quite good natured. I haven't really heard anything terrible being said by Trump, but of course it's been also dominated by this ridiculous row over the story in the New York Post about Hunter Biden and his connections with the Ukraine, and lots of allegations being thrown around,
and emails being leaked and all the rest of it. The whole Trump and Biden thing, it just, this week is very crucial for both of them, but especially Trump, because he has a lot of ground to make up. Obviously, now, you know, they've set the debate and they're saying they're going to mute microphones.
Yeah, I don't know how that's going to work exactly.
But then that's not a debate. Mm. Yeah, it's not a debate, right? The nature of a debate is to go back and forth.
Yes.
That's what people tune into. I think both of them need to show a bit more restraint.
Yeah.
I'm very interested to see who the moderators are going to be for this particular debate. But it's very crucial for both of them.
Yeah.
I don't think the microphone thing is like...
It's not critical, but I suppose the problem is that there are some, it might actually help Trump, because there are some who said after the last one, and even Nigel Farage said that he might have been a little bit too
over
enthusiastic about interrupting, because he just wanted to set Biden off on his heels and just not let him have an opportunity to say anything, which at times didn't look great.
But I think one thing, you know, muting microphones will become social media fodder. Mm. So if you have Trump popping off and, you know, it's kind of like a DJ Khaled moment at the MTV Awards like 10 years ago. I'm pretty sure you don't remember. Unfortunately, that was my generation.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But he was
just going off about how he's the greatest. And then they muted his microphone and he was still going off.
Right.
And that became a social media meme moment.
Right.
You don't want that, Trump, because people already take the mickey out of you anyway.
Well, the other thing that Trump might do is he did against Hillary Clinton, he started walking around. Do you remember? At one point, he actually appeared behind her, which was quite weird and strange.
Yeah, like a ninja.
Very, very odd. But I suppose, again, he has to be careful. But you're right. It sort of depends on who's moderating it and what the point system is going to be. But he seems to be catching up with Biden a little bit. And Biden's own people are now saying, you know, let's not take anything for granted.
Let's go and vote,
Because, I mean, the big vote is going to be in one or two or maybe three states. The rest of it doesn't matter. I mean, it doesn't matter. Because of the weird way the system works, it doesn't matter how many people vote for Biden in California. Mm. You know, the whole of California can vote for him. It's still just one state.
One state, yeah. I think that's the beauty of the Electoral College system. I really admire the political system in the US, even though it's a bit of a...
Do you prefer the fact that it's state by state rather than by
definitely.
Numbers?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. I think that's it makes sense, because that's the nature of a union. Everyone should have an equal voice. I think, like you said, Trump only... Like, he needs three states. Pennsylvania, Ohio,
Michigan. Probably.
I think Pennsylvania, because of the fracking thing, I think it's a pretty safe bet for him. Ohio, farmers, we'll see.
Yeah.
And Michigan.
Well, I mean, I think he got Ohio last time because Hillary didn't even bother going there.
Yeah, exactly.
She said, just thought it was in the bag, so I thought there's no reason to go.
And, you know, Biden has the disadvantage that that Hillary didn't, in the sense that he's not as unlikable as Hillary, but he inspires zero passion.
Yeah. I mean, every Democrat that I speak to says, well, you know, yeah, we know he's not a great candidate, but, you know, of course we have to vote for him.
He's not alive. He's a corpse.
Well, he doesn't seem terribly terribly active. Let's put it that way.
I just call him the corpse.
Yeah. I mean, but of course, a lot of people think that if he did win, Kamala Harris would then more or less become the de facto president after a very short period of time.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's the thing that, you know, this is where the Democrats have shot themselves in the foot a little bit, because they chose the most unlikable candidate for the black community.
Mm.
And I'm assuming now they're trying to pass off what it really is, an Indian woman as a black woman.
Yeah.
So that's not very good in terms of trying to, you know, sweep up the minorities they were hoping to do with that move.
That brings us back in a way to Black Lives Matter, because it's unclear to me that if you are not actually black, you know, African-American or Caribbean based, that are you involved in Black Lives Matter? I mean, if you're what we would call an Asian woman or an Asian man from the Indian subcontinent, are you part of Black Lives Matter, or is that not allowed?
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of, I suppose, cognitive dissonance of this movement. But, you know, if you're looking at Black Lives Matter just in terms of its popularity in the US, it has plummeted. Since the whole riots and the protests and everything, it has really plummeted. So again, that's another thing that shot the Democrats in the foot, because that's something they were hoping to go off of, the whole rile of, you know, this, I suppose, supercharged identity politics game. So and that's a huge worry.
Yeah, because I think the people kind of in the middle are fed up with the extremists, aren't they? And they just want to go back to where it was before, where the left wing wasn't particularly left wing. I mean, I was always amazed when I was in America in the sort of 80s, that America was not really left wing or right wing. It was, I mean, both the Democrats and the Republicans, you couldn't choose much between them, really. Yeah. You know, it was all just a question of which personality you preferred.
Yeah, and now it's more polarized, which I suppose I prefer, because you can really distinguish between candidates. It's a lot clearer, but at the same time, it's like it's more extreme.
Yeah.
You know, one thing people have to realize is that no law enforcement have endorsed Joe Biden, which is a huge problem.
That is.
Following, you know, the summer of rioting, basically. So.
Right, yeah. So it's going to be fascinating to watch over the next couple of weeks. But as I say, we'll be bringing it live to everybody on the night as well. So that'll be interesting. But I don't think, I'm being told that we probably won't get any kind of result at all until maybe a couple of days later, maybe 3 days later. And in fact, I saw a story the other day that said that Trump, even if he loses, can somehow run again. I'm not quite sure how that works.
Yeah, I don't know how. I mean, have they looked through the Constitution? I don't think that's exactly how it works.
I mean, I would imagine if Donald Trump loses, he'll just if he decides he wants to try and fight the fact that it was an illegal election or something, he might do that. But he'll probably just go away and go back and make some more money, won't he?
Yeah, he'll just go into media. I mean, if Trump loses, Fox News should be very worried.
Well, there's a lot of talk that he's going to start up his own channel, isn't
there?
Well, we shall see. Now, he's a man, of course, who's been accused of all manner of things regarding women. Let's talk about John Leslie, who's on the front pages today. You're probably too young to remember John Leslie when he was a Blue Peter presenter.
Definitely.
But, you know, this is a guy who was outed wrongly, as it turns out, by Matthew Wright on the Matthew Wright Show on TV, as the man who had been supposedly accused of raping Ulrika Johnson. She'd written about it in her book, but she never said who it was. Now, it turns out it wasn't John Leslie, but the fact that he had been deliberately outed on television, his life has never really been the same. And I mean, while I'm not going to say that he's not a seedy character, because I think he is, you know, he's in court yesterday getting cleared of something that was supposed to have happened 12 years ago.
Of grabbing someone's boobs. And I mean,
And I mean, you know, who knows whether he did it or not. The fact is he's been found not guilty, so we should say that he didn't do it. But imagine how that must feel. I mean, I mean, no matter how horrible the guy is, it must be awful to have to go through something like that for that length of time.
And, you know, the jury only deliberated for 23 minutes.
Mm.
I mean, that is quite telling. This is my issue with, I suppose this goes back to the whole Me Too movement.
Yeah.
But this is my issue with, you know, the fact that the media has no boundaries and lacks sensitivity when it comes to, you know, sexual assault allegations on both sides.
Right.
I really don't think that you should be able to publish sexual assault allegations on any public figure.
Mm.
And that's not to say that if they're found guilty, you shouldn't do that. Yeah, you should do it when they're found guilty, because honestly, it's just so unfair.
Right.
And it really scares me, because I have a brother. If he was supposed to be sort of a top level athlete and was falsely accused of sexual assault, that's the end of his career.
Well, because it doesn't, I mean, regardless of whether you get found innocent, it tends to stick with the person.
Exactly.
Doesn't it? That's the problem. So you would favour a kind of a system whereby if there's an accusation made, both parties remain anonymous until the end.
Exactly. And I think, you know, that's really difficult because the media like to jump on anything.
Yeah.
And obviously, it's very saucy when you out someone as effectively a degenerate.
Yeah.
But that is something that I really think we should just draw the line on.
Well, I mean, without getting into the detail of it, we saw that in Parliament, didn't we, when an MP was accused of rape by somebody.
Yeah.
And then there were all sorts of people saying, well, we must suspend this person.
Yeah, he must leave Parliament.
Which one is wrong, because first of all, you then identify the person. Second of all, that then might help to identify the victim, who's meant to remain anonymous. So I don't know what's actually happening with that case, but you know, it's a very tricky area.
Yeah, I think that's something that both parties have a lot to lose. I don't think the media should be able to overstep that boundary.
No.
And it's the same thing with publishing, like, you know, children's pictures and stuff like that. It's very sensitive.
Yeah,
you know,
it really is. I mean, the headline on the front of the Mail: can John Leslie's reputation ever recover? Well, I think the answer is no, isn't it?
Yeah, it's this is the thing. It's a fickle business. Once your name is attached to something, it's very hard to shake it off.
Right. I mean, in his case, he does have a bit of a timeline. October 2002, wrongly identified on TV as the man who raped Ulrika Johnson.
December 2002, arrested over claims of indecent assault in 1997, but charges are dropped. June 2008, arrested over a rape and assault allegation from 1995, which didn't go to court.
Yeah.
And it's all this historical stuff as well, isn't it? Because that's the other problem that we've seen in showbiz, generally speaking, over the years, that people have been accused of doing things, quite rightly sometimes accused, but in other cases, not always. But Pete, the public seems to sort of want to believe the complainant.
Yeah,
all the time.
No, it's our natural instinct. You know, you want to kind of be on the side of the victim, because then you don't feel like a horrible person. But you know, we often forget that there's someone on the other side who hasn't actually been found guilty, who has a lot to lose.
Yes.
Sometimes even more to lose.
Right.
And you know, I think that's a boundary that shouldn't be crossed at all.
No, and I mean, it's difficult to legislate, I suppose, for it. In the sense that...
No, it's fairly simple. Just,
you know,
tell...
There are plenty of people out there that will make false allegations as well.
Mm. Yeah, but the thing is, if stuff like that is amplified by the mainstream media, you know, there are people that could say, I hit a baby today. You know, that's fine. You can just say what you want. But, you know, if it's not amplified by voices that are supposed to have credibility in society, it doesn't do as much damage.
But we do live now in times when you've got the sort of snoop brigade, haven't you?
Yeah.
Because they're being encouraged to snoop on each other by the government. So, I mean, you know, there's all sorts of people out there ready. I mean, if you become very well known, there'll be people watching you. And when they see you out in a restaurant, or if they see you out in a shop, if you're ever allowed to go out to another restaurant.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, they might, you know, well, look at, we saw, you know, she said she didn't drink. We saw her drinking a bottle of wine on her own. It might not be true.
I mean, if you have evidence, everyone has a camera phone these days. So if you have evidence, that's where you kind of get tripped up. But I think with the whole like sort of sexual assault thing, there's 50% of this country is male.
Yeah.
There's a whole group of people that would actually support that as well, because they're often the ones that have a lot to lose.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, an awful lot of footballers, of course, are
exactly. Cristiano Ronaldo and stuff like that, who really didn't want to settle with that lunatic that was accusing him of rape.
But then, of course, you then get the other side of the battle, where you get people saying, oh, well, he paid her off.
Yeah.
So he must have been guilty.
You see, that's the thing. It's very uncomfortable to be in that situation in the first place. We shouldn't be able to have any say on that. This man has children.
Yeah, absolutely right. Now, one more story that I want to touch upon with you before we let you go. Climate change scientists take more work and leisure flights than colleagues in other fields. Now, who would have known such a thing? Now, this coincides with the apparent release of a new movie with Greta Thunberg in it.
Yeah, which I will not be seeing.
I won't be paying to see it, that's for sure. I mean, if somebody wants me to look at it just because they want me to look at it. But, I mean, it's kind of unusual to release a movie when the cinemas are all closed as well. I mean, who's going to watch
it? I mean, there's that. I mean, yeah, and the movie industry is trying to find a way around that. I think they're, you know, increasing the prices of films so that if just one person watches it, kind of subsidizes two.
Yeah.
I don't know, that's something that I read about. I think the Greta Thunberg movie is absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
How did a 16-year-old autistic girl with virtually no education in science or what she's talking about become the voice of, you know, climate, I don't know, like fear mongering.
Is it not because you can see pollution or something like that, or see carbon
In the air? You know, I just wish there was like, you know, a Japanese trans Muslim boy with Down syndrome to say climate change is not real, and they could duel out, because it's kind of effectively like battle of identity politics.
I put out a tweet about this that I wouldn't be watching the film, and so I got the usual kind of, you stop attacking a child. You know, she's apart from the fact she's now 17, which is not a child.
Far from a child.
You know, when you're 17, you can actually choose the method of whatever it is that you want to do in all sorts of different areas. You know, on your own without your parents, right?
Yeah.
But the problem, I think, as well, is that, you know, people have sort of bought into this climate change thing. It's only really been interrupted by COVID. I mean, Boris Johnson seems incredibly sure that he wants to turn Britain into some green and pleasant land and you know, a place full of wind farms and people cycling around everywhere.
Those ugly
things.
It's
never going to happen.
Yeah. And, you know, Prince Philip is always telling... Is it Prince Philip?
Prince Charles.
He's always like, we have 10 years, then we have 2 years, then we have 18 months.
Right.
It's just, you know, it's permeated all aspects of society, and we're not actually having an objective view of this. Yes, the climate is changing. Yes, human activity has a lot to do with it. You know, we need... human ingenuity is infamous for being able to solve problems that we don't think we can solve. It should come down to that, not just, you know, making us pay more money to effectively an incompetent government.
Right.
Because that's what it is.
Well, it's all you've got to do is look around the streets of London, where Sadiq Khan has, thankfully, for the eco-lobbyists, you know, managed to make loads and loads of cycle lanes to reduce congestion and to get rid of all the pollution. Guess
what? It's worsened.
It's actually worse pollution and worse congestion because now there's people stuck in traffic jams all day pumping out terrible, horrible exhaust fumes.
And it actually makes me resent cyclists.
Well, it does. Sorry,
I don't drive in London anymore because obviously of Sadiq Khan. But right. Whenever I drive in London and I just get this close to hitting a cyclist, I'm like, I wouldn't feel bad, but I'm not going to do it.
No, I mean, I watch them every morning as I come into work. And, you know, there are some that adhere to the rules and they stop at the lights when they're red. Oh, they're just a complete nuisance. But there are always loads who do not. And there are loads who don't actually use the cycle lanes anyway. They just
I don't care whether they... I know this is a bit of a radical, but honestly, they're just a complete nuisance. If you're cycling in a congested city like London, you probably have a death wish.
Well, I wouldn't do it.
Yeah, I wouldn't do it. I just, you know... Gosh. Can't you go to Richmond Park or something?
Yeah, exactly. That would make a lot of sense. It really would.
Yeah.
Well, listen, Esther, great to see you again. Thank you very much indeed. We shall see you same time next week.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
I don't know whether any of you saw a picture yesterday that was doing the rounds of one Gary Lineker. You might remember Saint Gary Lineker. This is the guy who works for the BBC, gets paid almost £2 million a year by the BBC, and of course thinks that that entitles him to have a view on almost everything under the sun. He, of course, is completely and utterly exempt from the new rules of the BBC, which suggest that if you are a BBC presenter, you should really not be giving out your views on politics, because the new Director General, Tim Davey, has actually said that. He's also said that Gary Lineker is exempt from it. Picture of him on the front page of the Daily Star. It was out on Twitter last night of Gary Lineker in a shop wearing no mask. Now, this wouldn't matter, mostly, to most people, were it not for the fact that he tweeted out on July the 14th, "Why would anyone object to wearing a mask in a shop? It's not exactly a hardship. What a country of snowflakes we have become." Here's the picture, in case you haven't seen it. You can see he's very clearly standing in a shop without wearing a mask. Now, I'm not going to give him a hard time for not wearing a mask, because some people don't like wearing masks. However, most people who don't like wearing masks don't tell everybody else to start wearing one. That's the hypocrisy of the man. By the way, has anybody noticed that even now, some months after making his first pronouncement about adopting an illegal migrant, an asylum seeker, somebody coming on a dinghy from France, he still hasn't managed to find one. He still hasn't managed to actually get the process sorted out so that he can, in fact, house an illegal migrant. All he's got to do is pop down to Dover, where we are told there are still hundreds and hundreds of people arriving every single day. But Gary somehow hasn't managed to find somebody. He hasn't managed to identify anyone, and he hasn't managed to house anyone. So maybe it was all smoke and mirrors after all. Maybe it was all just virtue signalling. Could it be, Gary, that that is the case? I'd like to communicate with Gary Lineker about this, but of course he's blocked me on Twitter because I asked him about whether he was paying a reasonable amount of tax on the earnings that he made from Walker's crisps while telling everybody that they should eat healthily, of course. Here's what he said yesterday after he was found out walking around in a shop without a mask on, which is technically an offence, right? "In my old age, I went into a store," he calls it, a store. Oh, you're American now, Gary? "Went into a store and forgot to put my mask on." Forgot to put his mask on. "Was wondering why people were giving me daggers. Realised after a couple of minutes and hastily put it on. Felt awful and embarrassed. Apologies to those present." Well, sorry, apology not accepted, Mr. Lineker. If you're going to start being a hypocrite, then an apology is not going to be enough. I think you should make a very large donation to a charity of my choice. That's what I think you should do. And when on earth are you going to do what you said you were going to do, which is to give some shelter to an illegal migrant? Because it's now looking like it's never going to happen, I'm afraid. What an absolute plank.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now it's time to say a very good afternoon to Dr. Raqib Hassan from the Centre on Radicalisation and Terrorism. He's written a piece in The Telegraph today about the whole business of that terrible, terrible thing that happened in Paris. There have been marches in the streets of Paris. It hasn't been covered massively by the press in this country, strangely enough, but there have been massive reactions over in France because this young man was allowed to or was able to behead a teacher in broad daylight, effectively, just because he was advocating free speech. Dr. Raqib, very good afternoon to you.
Afternoon, Mike. How are you?
Yeah, very well indeed. Thanks very much for joining us on this one. A terrible, awful event, well, the like of which we thought maybe we'd seen the back of. You've written a piece in which you say that we should be massively wary now of this kind of thing. Tell us why.
Well, I think that in the piece that I authored for The Telegraph, I said that it should be a wake-up call for the rest of Europe. Mm. I felt that this terrorist attack, this was not simply a gruesome murder of a school teacher. I felt that it was a vicious attack on the integrity of the French Republic, its long and rich history of secularism. And it does speak to broader issues of sovereignty. Who decides what can be said in the public realm? What kind of materials are used in schools? To what extent should religious sensitivities be respected in the social mainstream? Mm. So I feel that, you know, countries, these are just not problems in France when we're looking at the threat of Islamist separatism. These are also problems in the UK, in Germany and other European countries. And I do feel that for too long, political classes within those different countries, they haven't taken this issue seriously enough, or rather that they're just reluctant because of the sensitivities which surround these kind of social problems.
Sure. And interesting that this kid came from Chechnya, because up until, I suppose, that murder last Friday, Chechnya had kind of gone out of everybody's consciousness, hadn't it? And we'd almost forgotten that it was a very bloody war waged there, a civil war between the Russian state and Islamic separatists in Chechnya, who were trying to make it into an Islamic state.
Well, I'd make the point there that I feel when we're talking about the broader political culture in Western Europe, I think that mainstream politicians, they've almost overindulged in pursuing socially liberal policies, especially when it comes to immigration, refugee asylum policy, social integration, social cohesion. And they fail to understand the risks involved if there are unsuccessful integration outcomes among individuals who come from, you know, unstable and vastly different cultural and religious contexts. To integrate, if there's a failure to integrate those individuals into conventional liberal democratic society, then you have a very serious problem on your hands when it comes to community relations in modern day European societies.
Exactly right. And you were saying as well that there was a speech that Emmanuel Macron made back in October, I think, in which he said that he was going to address this whole Islamic separatist issue, because France does have a big problem, doesn't it?
Well, I say that France certainly does have a big problem. So if I just give you some statistics, survey data rather, there was a survey of French Muslims back in 2016. 29% of the French Muslims polled said that ultimately the sort of Islamic moral and legal code Sharia, it felt it was more important for them to follow that as opposed to French secular law. Now, in that survey, a quarter of the respondents were classified as hardliners. So these are usually young people who lived in the outskirts of cities, low-skilled, not particularly well-integrated in the French labour market, who are supportive of the wearing of the burqa, polygamy, and the general supremacy of Islamic law. So you do see that there are very serious problems there when you're looking at... It's almost a construction of a counter-society. In France, and you see the sort of religious authoritarianism there, it directly contradicts the French secular law and, you know, the sort of principle of laïcité. France is formally stated as a secular republic in Article 1 of its own constitution. So you see that there's these competing tensions here. Mm. So President Macron's speech, they say that timing is everything in politics. And, you know, fast forward just a few days after that speech, we have this terrifying Islamist terrorist attack in the northwestern suburbs of Paris.
Well, this is it. And I mean, if you remember back to the Bataclan atrocity, so many of the people involved in that who did the shooting had come from that town over in Belgium, which is more or less a no-go zone for the police, where it was basically, you know, 100% kind of Islamic fundamentalists who were kind of running it. And it was a very dangerous place. I don't even know if that still exists, whether that's been changed, whether that's been addressed. But certainly it looked like a very dangerous place 4 or 5 years ago.
Well, Mike, I made the point that in my piece for The Telegraph, that in the post-COVID world, Europe's leaders really have to get together understand the threat of Islamist separatism in their specific countries, and what kind of collective action can be taken to reduce that threat. Also, you know, what kind of policy approaches can be taken to significantly reduce public support within segregated communities for, you know, deeply authoritarian ideologies which run directly run counter to conventional liberal democratic norms. And I think that's something that needs to be prioritised, right, and that should be at the heart of social policy across a number of European countries.
Well, something that you also were remarking upon, which amazed me, was the not very many, but several kind of academics, Islamic academics in this country, who basically were calling for the closing down of Charlie Hebdo magazine on the basis that it was too provocative and somehow offensive to Muslims, as though having a magazine was equated to murdering people.
Well, I'd make the point that if you close down a particular publisher, that's not going to automatically improve social cohesion in the French Republic. The reality of the matter is, if you were to take on that kind of action, you'd only serve to embolden Islamist extremist elements within the French Muslim population. Thereby, you'd actually be weakening patriotic reformist figures within the French Muslim population as well.
Yeah, but I'm talking about people, academics in this country, Ricky.
Oh yeah, well, I think that we've had Muslim figures in the UK who've called for the shutting down of Charlie Hebdo. And I'd really make the point that whether it's in France, the UK, or Germany, if you go down the road of banning particular publishers, banning specific materials, you run the risk of generating a cultural backlash in the secular-minded mainstream. You embolden Islamist extremist elements within the broader Muslim population in countries of Europe. And you would also empower hard-right political factions who, you know, that they provide these arguments of their societies running the risk of being, you know, suffering some kind of Islamist takeover. Mm. So the idea that if you take these kind of actions, you would improve social cohesion outcomes. I'm sorry, Mike, that is quite laughable.
Yeah, well, it is, absolutely. Yeah. It is absolutely laughable. But, I mean, as long as we've got people in places like the University of Durham who are calling for this kind of thing to happen, and basically saying that it's an absolute insult to an entire religion to allow this publication to exist, as if to justify the actions of the guy who beheaded a teacher, it's quite frankly extraordinary. I mean, if you had said the equivalent, and you were not an Islamic academic, I suspect you'd be out on your ear. But apparently, this guy's still working there.
Well, I've made the point that, you know, I've seen individuals frame this Islamist terrorist attack as a state-led anti-Muslim brutality, because the police, the terrorist had shown threatening behaviour towards the police after he had decapitated a school teacher on the street.
Yeah,
there's people say, this was heavy-handed.
Yeah, why did they shoot him when he only had a knife?
I think it's quite remarkable, really, that this vicious Islamist terrorist attack is somehow being repackaged as a you know, an episode of state-led anti-Muslim brutality. It's one of the most egregious forms of victimhood politics that I've come across in a very long time.
Yeah. And what about the French people's reaction? Because I haven't seen quite so many people out on the street about something like this for a long time.
Well, I'd make the point that, and I said this earlier, Mike, that this was ultimately a vicious attack on the integrity of the French Republic.
Saying is that why is there more of a kind of reaction to this than there has been to anything else before?
Well, I think it's almost a case where school teachers in France, for example, they're almost seen as almost like a frontline infantry when it comes to representing France's secular liberal traditions. So the school teacher in this case was showing cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in a civics class on freedom of expression. So and then for the gruesome demise that he suffered at the hands of an Islamist terrorist, I think that it's a real wake up call even within France, that there might be a feeling within the secular French mainstream that we've simply had enough of you know, the kind of influence of religious and authoritarianism within the French Republic, and there needs to be a robust pushback to this.
And is there a big Chechen population in France, or is this kind of likely to be a kind of one-off situation?
Well, I'd make the point, Mike, that Islamist terrorist attacks which are taking place in France, the perpetrators have been of different ethnic backgrounds. What I will say, though, for just make a broader point, that when it comes to refugee policy, we need to have a robust integration framework in place. If refugees who have, you know, they may well have experienced traumatic events in their country of origin, that to successfully integrate refugees into the new society, you could say that serious effort needs to be put in to do that. And I feel that policymakers, members of the political classes, they feel very generous spirited when they put forward a liberal refugee policy, but they fail to understand the risks involved. If integration afterwards, if it fails, there's very serious problems that may arise for wider society.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Dr. Rakib Hassan, Centre on Radicalisation and Terrorism at the Henry Jackson Society. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Read his piece on Twitter. I've put it out there. It's in the Telegraph today.
Talk radio across the UK, online, on DAB and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday on Talk Radio via DAB online or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.